Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm your genial host, Alex P. Linder with VNNforum.com, alexlinder.com. Today we're going to go to the Leo Frank Case Research Library and we're going to look at Judge Leonard Roan's instructions to the jury on conviction of Leo Frank, Monday afternoon, August 25th, 1913. You can find this, the text, at leofrank.org. You can find the archive of this recording at vnnforum.com, also alexlinder.com, as with everything that we do, and we've done a very great amount on Leo Frank. Let's dig in. Again, this is Judge Leonard Roan's instructions to the jury and conviction of Leo Frank from August 25th, 1913. Start with a picture of the Judge Roan, kind of a Western mustache, straw boater hat, dressed up in a suit, looks like a pocket watch. This is how they dressed in 1900. Then a picture of the jury that convicted Frank as the slayer of Mary Fagan, this 20-something Jew who's hitting on, molesting, killing, lying about, trying to blame others, a couple blacks, trying to frame them. This 20-something Leo Frank and this 13-year-old white girl that he murdered. And always remember, the ADL was founded to defend this Jew and claim that anyone who supported his being hanged, as was his sentence, is an evil white racist hater. And they claim Leo Frank was lynched. Well, in a narrow construction of the verb lynched, he was. He was indeed taken out of jail and hanged. But it wasn't unjust. What was unjust was they were trying to bribe people to get his sentence commuted, and they're claiming today that he was unjustly convicted by evil, hateful, racist, anti-Semitic Southerners. And indeed, this case became the basis for defaming the South generally, because white men dared to stand up and protect one of their own, Tom Watson being one of the leaders, as we've heard other times. So now let's look at the judge's instructions, Judge Roan, R-O-A-N, to the jury in the conviction of Leo Frank, 25 August 1913, 104 years before I'm reading you this in 2017. The jury were given their orders from the judge Leonard Strickland Roan after Hugh M. Dorsey completed his closing arguments that ended on noon Monday, August 25th, 1913, colon. And here we go with the statement. Judge Leonard Strickland Roan giving the orders to the jury. Gentlemen of the jury, this bill of indictment charges Leo M. Frank with the offense of murder. The charge that Leo M. Frank, in this county, on the 26th day of April of this year, notice how quickly this justice was speedily rendered, with force of arms, so they're trying him in August for a crime that was committed at the end of April, so April to May to June, July, August, so in 4 months later, they already have wrapped up the case, the day before the four-month anniversary of the crime. Gentlemen of the jury, this bill of indictment charges Leo M. Frank with the offense of murder. The charge that Leo M. Frank, in this county, on the 26th day of April of this year, with force and arms, did unlawfully and with malice aforethought kill and murder one Mary Fagan by then and there choking her, the said Mary Fagan, with a cord placed around her neck. To this charge, made by the bill of indictment found by the grand jury of this county recently impaneled, Leo M. Frank, the defendant, files a plea of not guilty. The charge as made by the bill of indictment, on the one hand, and his plea of not guilty filed thereto, form the issue. And you, gentlemen of the jury, have been selected, chosen, and sworn to try the truth of this issue, whether he did or did not kill Mary Fagan. Leo M. Frank, the defendant, commences the trial of this issue with a presumption of innocence in his favor, and this presumption of innocence remains with him to shield him and protect him until the state shall overcome it and remove it by evidence offered to you in your hearing and presence, sufficient in its strength and character to satisfy your minds beyond a reasonable doubt of his guilt of each and every material allegation made by the bill of indictment. Not an absolute doubt, not anything you can invent, but a reasonable doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt. All you can be in the end is a serious man acting rationally, and that's what the Anglo-Saxon common law, based on the Roman law, is putting out there. Because ultimately, all this legal stuff comes back to a reasonable man. How would a reasonable man have acted? If there's no common reason, then pretty much everything is arbitrary, right? And I don't think the English common law actually was based on Roman law. Maybe a little bit in part. But let's continue. I charge you, gentlemen, and I should have said, the picture of the jury above, they're all men. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. So they probably had a few alternates, and 12 in the jury, and maybe 3 alternates. They're all men. They're all dressed in suits. They have hats, as was the style, as the judge had. They have bow ties or long ties or neckties. Picture of them. I charge you, gentlemen, that all of the allegations of this indictment are material, and it is necessary for the state to satisfy you of their truth by evidence that convinces your minds beyond a reasonable doubt of his guilt before you would be authorized to find a verdict of guilty. So he's bending over backward to make it clear that every benefit of the doubt is reserved to this obnoxious little yid, is how I would read this. Because they're aware of the media pressure. Remember, there were at least three papers covering this extensively, sometimes multiple times, repeatedly daily in Atlanta. This was before the electronic age for the most part. And there was heavy media coverage. Because a Jew is involved, a prominent Jew, head of the B'nai B'rith down there in Atlanta, it became a national case as well, used to try the South and set up one of the first sort of national de facto network gang attacks on whites and the white community. And what would think would be the worst possible case, a literal pedophile murderer. Yet he becomes the basis for a national campaign of defamation against the good white men of the South and the entire region. Think about that, what it tells you about the Jew mentality. And they haven't given it up 100 years later. If you set up a news alert for Leo Frank, what you'll hear about are plays based on his being anti-Semitically lynched. He becomes somehow the victim, and they push this lie forever and ever, for decades and decades, for 100 years after this, after he was brought to justice by the good men of the South. They push the lie that he is the victim rather than the girl he hit on, and then literally hit, and then strangled, and then lied about to get away with it, tried to blame it on a couple different blacks. Although the good white men of the state of Georgia saw through it, and duly found him guilty, at all levels of the criminal system up to the Supreme Court. Now, you are back to the text. You are not compelled to find from the evidence his guilt beyond any doubt, but beyond a reasonable doubt. Such a doubt as grows out of the evidence in this case, or the want of evidence, such a doubt as a reasonable and impartial man would entertain about matters of the highest importance to himself, after all reasonable efforts to ascertain the truth. This does not mean a fanciful doubt, like one conjured up by the jury, but a reasonable doubt. It's like, you know, elves came out of the woodwork and strangled her while Leo, you know, that's a fanciful doubt. But a reasonable doubt is, look, was there anyone else around who could have done it? Look, you know, you say this guy did it, but there were two or three other people that were known to be in there at the same time. We don't know that they didn't do it. See, that would be a reasonable doubt. There's a reason, a valid reason. It all hangs on basic rationality and then basic honesty to employ that rationality. Gentlemen, this defendant is charged with murder. Murder is defined to be the unlawful killing of a human being in the peace of the state by a person of sound memory and discretion, with malice aforethought, either express or implied. Express malice is that deliberate intention unlawfully to take away the life of a fellow creature, which is manifested by external circumstances capable of proof. Malice shall be implied where no considerable provocation appears, and where all of the circumstances of the killing show an abandoned and malignant heart. It's like you had no reason to kill this person. There was no provocation. There was nothing. It wasn't in self-defense. You did it out of an abandoned and malignant heart. And abandoned was the word often in a sexual connotation or association, usually used with abandoned women who had abandoned their morals and had sex, hence were early, hence were, in the thinking of the time, going to be, they were not no longer good women or prostitutes was kind of the basic division. The mentality reflected it, because back then there was no birth control, there was no X, Y, and Z, and women essentially needed a husband to see them through life, and if they abandoned their morals, they couldn't get one. They'd be fallen women, and they might have to turn to prostitution. Now it was overdrawn. It wasn't really that black and white, but it was much more black and white then than it is today, for various technical and social reasons. So, in this context, an abandoned heart wouldn't really be sexual, although the specific triggering of this malicious little Jew's actions was sexual, in that he was lustful toward this girl, as was shown in the evidence. He did know her name. He had been overly friendly with her, and he took it way beyond that to actually killing her when she rejected his advances. And that shows he has an abandoned and malignant heart. He's abandoned any kind of self-control. He's abandoned not only his manners and his morals, but he's abandoned the legally safe position of not murdering people, because while it's not strictly immoral to hit on women like this when, you know, again, he's in his later 20s and married, or 26 and married. He was 26 or 27 and married, and she is 13. He's twice her age. She's not even 14 years old, and he's hitting on her, and he's married. Right, so he's just going to use her and abuse her, as the Jews say they are justified in doing in their Talmud. And he's not only a Jew, he's the head of the B'nai B'rith there in Atlanta, so he's a top Jew, top kike, right? And this is how he acts. And when he does it, this is how the broader Jewish community acts. Do they back him up, or do they retreat from him and say, oh, we're sorry that one of ours acted so shamefully? No, they back him up even 100 years later. They're backing him up today when I'm reading this to you in 2017, 104 years after he delivered these words to the jury. Think about what that tells you about Jews and how tight they are, how much of a team they are, and how they absolutely do not care what theirs do to yours. You must form a team against them and destroy them, because they will back their own pedophile murderer against your innocent little virgin teenage girl. I mean, think about that, what that tells you about Jews. And you white-skinned evangelist idiots are out there worshiping these people who back a pedophile murderer of one of your own kind. You're absolutely insane. Are you genetically insane, or has your Christianity made you that way? Sometimes I wonder, do they work in a ratchet effect? One pushes the other. Your gullibility left you open to Christianity, and your Christianity enhanced your gullibility. Made it into what you think is a virtue, but is actually not a virtue. It's very, very socially destructive. It's good to be intellectual and smart and know things. It's bad to be stupid and gullible and naive. That's the truth. Now, continuing with Judge Rome. This is overall is not a super, super long thing, so Roan says, there's no difference between express and implied malice except in the mode of arriving at the fact of its existence. The legal sense of the term malice is not confined to particular animosity to the deceased, but extends to an evil design in general. The popular idea of malice in its sense of revenge, hatred, ill will has nothing to do with the subject. It is an intent to kill a human being in a case where the law would neither justify or in any degree excuse the intention if the killing should take place as intended. Malice just means he's basically saying, look, it's not the typical use that you would use in everyday life. In law, it means essentially will to commit an illegal act shows a malicious disposition. It is a deliberate intent unlawfully to take a human life. That's all it means. Quote, whether it springs from hatred, ill will, or revenge, ambition, avarice, or any other like passion. In this case, it sprang from lust. A man may form the intent to kill, do the killing instantly, and regret the deed as soon as done. Malice must exist at the time of the killing. It need not have existed any length of time previously. When a homicide is proven, if it is proven to be the act of the defendant, the law presumes malice, and unless the evidence should relieve the slayer, he may be found guilty of murder. The presumption of innocence is removed by proof of the killing by the defendant. When the killing is shown to be the act of the defendant, it is then on the defendant to justify or mitigate the homicide. Well, I did it for this reason. He was going to kill me. I had to kill him. Okay, let's consider that. The proof to do that may come from, I killed him, but I mean, he was in bed with my wife. You know, that would mitigate it. The proof to do that may come from either side, either from the evidence offered by the state to make out its case, or from the evidence offered by the defendant or the defendant's statement. Gentlemen of the jury, you are made by the law the sole judges of the credibility of the witnesses and the weight of the testimony of each and every witness. It is for you to take this testimony as you have heard it in connection with the defendant's statement and arrive at what you believe to be the truth. Gentlemen, the object of all legal investigation is the discovery of the truth. That is the reason of you being selected and paneled and sworn in this case, to discover what is the truth on this issue formed on this bill of indictment, this issue or this disagreement that it must be settled by the legal process. Is Leo M. Frank guilty? Are you satisfied of that beyond a reasonable doubt from the evidence in this case? Or is his plea of not guilty the truth? The rules of evidence are framed with a view to this prominent end, seeking always for pure sources and the highest evidence. Direct evidence is that which immediately points to the question at issue. Indirect or circumstantial, like if you had a video of him strangling Mary Fagan, that would be direct evidence. Indirect or circumstantial evidence is that which only tends to establish the issue by proof of various facts sustaining, by their consistency, the hypothesis claimed. To warrant a conviction on circumstantial evidence, the proven facts must not only be consistent with the hypothesis of guilt, but must exclude every other reasonable doubt, hypothesis, save that of the guilt of the accused. It's like, well, you know, dirt under her, we found his DNA under her nails, we found, you know, a cord around her neck, and we there was no one else there at the time, you know, blah, 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 blah. The black guy says he asked him to cover up the body, you know, stuff like that. The black guy didn't see him do it, but he was asked to help cover up the body, so, you know, that is circumstantial. The defendant has introduced testimony as to his good character. On this subject, I charge you that evidence of good character, when offered by the defendant in a criminal case, is always relevant and material and should be considered by the jury, along with all the other evidence introduced, as one of the facts of the case. It should be considered by the jury not merely whether the balance of the testimony in the case makes it doubtful whether the defendant is guilty or not, but also where such evidence of good character may of itself generate a doubt as to the defendant's guilt. Good character is a substantial fact, like any other fact tending to establish the defendant's innocence, and ought to be so regarded by the jury. Like all other facts proved in the case, it should be weighed and estimated by the jury, for it may render that doubtful which otherwise would be clear. It's like, oh, let's look at his consistent behavior over time to indicating his character and see what the people who know him say, and that will help provide some of the context that makes it a little easier to judge if there is any doubt whether he did this horrible thing. However, it doesn't matter how good if the guilt of the accused is plainly proved to the satisfaction of the jury beyond a reasonable doubt, notwithstanding the proof of good character, it is their duty to convict. It's like, look, the best man in the world, if he still killed this person and for whatever reason, his good character can't be used to excuse him or protect him. You have to find him guilty. But the jury may consider the good character of the defendant, whether the rest of the testimony leaves the question of his guilt doubtful or not, and if a consideration of the proof of his good character, considered along with the evidence, creates a reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury as to the defendant's guilt, then it would be the duty of the jury to give the defendant the benefit of the doubt thus raised by his good character and to acquit him. The character, as used in this connection, means that general reputation which he bore among the people who knew him prior to the time of the death of Mary Fagan. Therefore, when the witnesses by which a defendant seeks to prove his good character are put upon the stand and testify that his character is good, the effect of the testimony is to say that the people who knew him spoke well of him, and that his general reputation was otherwise good. When a defendant has put his character in issue, the state is allowed to attack it by proving that his general reputation is not good, or by showing that the witnesses who have stated that his character is good have untruly reported it, i.e. lied. Hence, the Solicitor General has been allowed to cross-examine the witnesses for the defense who were introduced to testify to his good character. In the cross-examination of these witnesses, he was allowed to ask them if they had not heard of various acts of misconduct on the defendant's part. The Solicitor General had the right to ask any question along the lines he pleased in order thoroughly to sift the witnesses and to see if anything derogatory to the defendant's reputation could be proved by them. The court now wishes to say to you that although the Solicitor General was allowed to ask the defendant's character witnesses these questions as to their having heard of various acts of alleged misconduct on the defendant's part, the jury is not to consider this as evidence that the defendant has been guilty of any such misconduct as it may have been indicated in the questions of the Solicitor General or any of them, unless the alleged witnesses testify to it. He can say that, but it's basically saying the fact that they didn't, you know, try to impugn these witnesses, said, yeah, he had lewd women into the office off hours, and he used to consort with them even though he was married. He's saying don't let that influence you, but basically it would influence people because they didn't dare take them on because it would have opened up avenues that would have been impossible to defend. And you said, look, this guy is basically a scumbag who got off on debauching white women in an age when that actually meant something. It wasn't an age of loose sex. It wasn't an age of promiscuity. It was an age where you rolled your entire existence dice on contracting a good marriage with a good woman. With a good man, and you couldn't get a good man if you were, you know, essentially used goods, or it was much harder. So now, back to the text. Furthermore, quote, where a man's character is put in evidence, and in the course of the investigation, any specific act of misconduct is shown, this does not go before the jury for the purpose of showing affirmatively that his character is bad or that he is guilty of the offense with which he stands charged, but is to be considered by the jury only in determining the credibility and the degree of information possessed by those witnesses who have testified to his good character. When the defendant has put his character in issue, the state is allowed to bring witnesses to prove that his general character is bad and thereby to disprove the testimony of those who have stated that it is good. The jury is allowed to take this testimony and have the right to consider it, along with all the other evidence introduced on the subject of the general character of the defendant, and it is for the jury, finally, to determine from all the evidence whether his character was good or bad. But a defendant is not to be convinced of the crime with which he stands charged, even though, upon a consideration of all the evidence as to his character, the jury believes that his character is bad, unless from all the other testimony in the case they believe that he is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. You will therefore observe that this is the rule you will be guided by in determining the effect to be given to the evidence on the subject of the defendant's character. If, after considering all of the evidence pro and con on the subject of the defendant's character, you believe that prior to the time of Mary Fagan's death he bore a good reputation among those who knew him, that his general character was good, you will consider that as one of the facts of the case, and it may be sufficient to create a reasonable doubt of the defendant's guilt, if it so impress your minds and consciences after considering it along with all the other evidence of the case. And if it does, you should give the defendant the benefit of the doubt and acquit him. However, though you should believe his general character was good, still, if, after giving due weight to it as one of the facts in the case, you believe from the evidence as a whole that he is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, you would be authorized to convict him. So, if a man's character comes into issue and we hear he's good or bad, you make up your minds, and if that fact of his character, and he said it is a substantial fact, but it's one of a number of facts, and so you do take it into account, and you can use it as a fact, what people generally thought about his character at the time this crime was committed, or before, leading up to the point at which this crime was committed, not after, obviously. If you believe beyond a reasonable doubt from the evidence in this case that this defendant is guilty of murder, then you would be authorized to say, in that event, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty. Should you go no further, gentlemen, and say nothing else in your verdict, the court would have to sentence the defendant to the extreme penalty for murder, to wit, to be hanged by the neck until he is dead. But should you see fit to do so, in the event you arrive at the conclusion and belief beyond a reasonable doubt from the evidence that this defendant is guilty, then, gentlemen, you would be authorized in that event, if you saw fit to do so, to say, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty, and we recommend that he be imprisoned in the penitentiary for life. In the event you should make such a verdict as that, then the court, under the law, would have to sentence the defendant to the penitentiary for life, so I guess they can decide whether he gets a death penalty or not, as well as deciding whether he's guilty or not. You've heard the defendant make his statement. He had the right to make it under the law. It is not made under oath, and he is not subject to examination or cross-examination. That was his decision, because he couldn't really bear being questioned. They thought it best not to let him be questioned, so he just made a statement, as the judge is saying, he is not subject in that statement to examination or cross-examination afterward. It is with you as to how much of it you will believe or how little of it. You may go to the extent, if you see fit, of believing it in preference to the sworn testimony in the case. So basically you can make of the defendant's statement what you will. In the event, gentlemen, you have a reasonable doubt from the evidence, or the evidence and the statement together, or either, as the defendant's guilt as charged, then give the prisoner the benefit of that doubt and acquit him. And in the event you do acquit him, the form of your verdict would be, quote, we, the jury, find the defendant not guilty. As honest jurors, do your utmost to reach the truth from the evidence and statement as you have heard it here, then let your verdict speak it. Saying you have to decide on this and this, and you come to this conclusion, you put it in this form. Since, again, this is the system we have. You know, you're judging your peers. You're not trained lawyers, and the lawyer explains this is what you need to do, and this is the form it takes. But the guts of this are up to you. You decide. Is this guy guilty or is he innocent? And then there's a picture of the 12 jurors with whom Leo M. Frank's fate rests, and they're all white men. And, you know, they look pretty reasonable. I suppose a cross-section of Georgia at that time. All wearing suits. All wearing hats, too. I don't know if there are onions in their belts because their picture are busts. The jury began deliberation at 1:30 p.m. At one point during the review, a vote was taken, and the result was 11-1. The dissenting voter told the group he didn't want a fast conviction, but for his fellow jurymen to spend more time discussing the case. As a result, the jury continued to deliberate, and at 4:39 p.m., after more than 3 hours behind closed doors, the jury came to a unanimous decision after a second and final vote. The verdict was guilty as charged, and sentencing recommendation was, quote, without mercy, implying a death sentence for Leo Frank. The verdict was delivered to Judge Leonard Stickland Roan, not Strickland, but Stickland Roan, at 4:56 p.m., and then each jury member was polled individually. And then there's a picture of Leo Frank, Popeye little Jew, pedophile murderer, and the beautiful young Aryan lady he killed, Mary Fagan. And finally, just post-conviction, Subtitle, the Leo M. Frank conviction is most often cited as the impetus for inspiring the founding of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, the ADL, by Sidney Livingston in the fall of month of October 1913. Right? So a couple months after this verdict is rendered. Anyway, that's what the judge said to the jury. That's what happened. And thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.